GTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I am exceptionally interested in today's topic, and I hope that you will be too, about the earliest days of radio. The book at hand is called Hello Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. And this book, better than any other I've ever seen or read, helps us understand how groundbreaking the technology of radio was and the way in which it utterly reshaped American life and culture. And in this modern age in which we live, in which we seem to be plugged into everything and everybody all around the globe, it's helpful for us to step back in time and try to remember what it was like before any such technology existed. Radio might seem now, in some respects, compared to some of these other new technologies, fairly antiquated, but it was an absolutely breathtaking revolution in its day. The author of the book at hand is Anthony Rudell, with many, many years of experience in the world of radio, and also author of the novel Imagining Don Giovanni. He's written about classical music as well. This book, again, is called Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. Anthony Rudell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Really looking forward to talking to you. Ahead of talking about how radio itself came about, I wonder if you would just talk for a moment about how one goes about studying the earliest days of radio. What has it left behind in its wake, in a sense, that is left for historians like yourself to explore and study?
Well, the thing about radio in the years I cover, 1920 to 1933, is that everything was new. And the beauty of that is everyone commented on everything that was new. The newspapers kept looking at these radio people and going, wow, that's kind of interesting. So there were thousands of newspaper articles I read in order to do this. But what they've left behind is a legacy. And, you know, I have children who think the Internet is, you know, the greatest thing in the world. And what I try to explain to them is without what radio did in those 12 years, the Internet couldn't exist today, and television couldn't exist today. The foundation of all American cultural media is in those 12 years. So it's a wealth of material to look back at and to listen. You know, when you can find an audio clip, it's pretty nice to listen to.
That last thing I want to ask you about real quick as well. Sometimes in your book, you are giving us what sounds like your own blow-by-blow account of exactly what somebody said or exactly what something sounded like. But I am suspecting that in the vast majority of cases, we have to sort of take the word of somebody who heard that in fact the actual audio that exists of the very earliest days of radio must be frustratingly elusive.
Well, it is frustrating. There are some clips of people like Amy Semple McPherson, because they recorded a lot of what she did for playback later on and use in other places. So you can hear some of that. But what was really eye-opening to me was that the newspapers printed line-by-line verbatim reports of what radio had done. So while you couldn't hear the expression or the words, you know, how it was said, you could read exactly what they said. So, for example, in boxing, you got the blow-by-blow call reprinted in the newspaper the next day. And when a politician, and I cover, you know, many of the big the presidential campaigns, which is kind of timely for now, from 24, 28, and 32, the newspapers literally ran verbatim reports of what the candidates said on the radio. The newspapers were fascinated by this thing, and yet never anticipated that the radio would begin to take away their revenue, which was kind of the irony of how newspapers dealt with broadcasters.
Right. They seemed like best buddies in the early going, and then that becomes a rather uneasy friendship, and then something more antagonistic than that.
Well, yeah. When you get to about 19... From 1925 on, the newspaper publishers met every year and had a committee talking about radio. And every year, the committee reported back that radio was doing no harm to newspapers and they could continue to coexist. Then the crash of 29 occurs. In 1930, they say, well, maybe it's having a little bit of impact, but it's a fad. It won't hang on. And then in 1931, they issue a report that says, we've got to do something about radio. So sort of they came to the party a little late. But for those, what was wonderful in terms of the research is that in those years of 21 through about 31, that decade, the newspapers literally would run whole pages of nothing but radio commentary.
Hmm.
So you could read the words of what the boxing commentator said during the bout. You'd hear, or the World Series, for example. You would hear what Graham McNamee, who was one of the great announcers back in that era, would say about the Yankees. So you could really quote them, and it makes the book come alive a little bit more.
It absolutely does. And of course, it in a sense, I mean, on one hand, it made your job easier, or it made your job possible and doable. But on the other hand, you had a mountain of material to sift through in order to allow this book to take shape.
It was a huge amount of research, but it was. As a radio junkie myself, and somebody who made a career in it for a lot of years, I kind of enjoyed going back and seeing this genesis of the industry that we think of today as radio. And you'd read the excitement in the newspaper articles. The New York Times in September of 1925 devoted an entire section of the newspaper to radio. That's how groundbreaking it seemed to them. And yet they didn't acknowledge that it was a business threat, which I think is kind of funny.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a moment about the technology of radio and the other technologies from which it sprang. One of the things you tell us is that what certain scientists were really working hard on was the possibility of developing what would amount to a wireless telegraph.
Exactly.
Telegraph without the cumbersome wires that were filling the skies of major cities, for instance. Tell us how we got from that to this, to radio.
Well, it's kind of strange. I mean, I came out of the creative, the programming side of radio, and I've worked with engineers my whole career, and so when I was doing the research for the book, I realized I didn't actually understand how radio worked. So I said to them, well, explain this to me. And five chief engineers of major radio stations said the following. Well, the sound goes into an amplifier, it gets excited, it goes up into the transmitter, gets sent out into the air, it gets picked up by another receiver, brought down, reamplified, and that's how you get sound. And I said, well, how does it get from point A to point B? Well, it goes on invisible ether waves. And I said, well, how does that happen? And they all looked at me and said, it just does. And so this sort of leap of faith that it just does troubled me, and yet there is no real answer, but the answer is sound travels that way. It just does. And so as you say, the original intent was to go point to point, kind of like cell phones do in essence, where you could pick up a phone and there's no wire, and you get to one specific point. So that was the original intent, but radio signals have this horrible habit of bouncing around, of scattering. And so radio technicians were frustrated that they couldn't get, you know, anyone who could tune into that frequency could intercept the signal. So there went the whole concept of point-to-point. And it was David Sarnoff who said, well, let's turn it into a business. And there's a, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but a wonderful story about an executive at RCA who was his boss who said, you know, forget the idea of creating a business out of this. No one will ever pay anything to listen to music out of a box that comes through the air. So forget about it. But Sarnoff did not give up, and he pushed RCA, and eventually radio was born.
Let me just jump in, because you described this sort of leap of imagination of David Sarnoff, I think, so well, when you say Sarnoff, more than any other pioneer, saw ways to exploit the potential in wireless's greatest flaw, the propensity of radio waves to disseminate over a wide field, to bounce around and spread out over great distances. I mean, as you were saying before, because this wasn't the initial intent of some of these exploits, it was seen as a drawback that this didn't go from person A to person B, that it was spreading all over the place. It was actually a rather few people who seemed to realize, wait a minute, we have something brand new here that's in some ways far more exciting than this first thing that was our original intent.
That's exactly it. You got to understand that people didn't know what to do with this, what to make of it. That no one thought, we had no broadcasting. There was no media business yet. It was all trying to get messages from one point to another. I think one of the most telling things of how radio was viewed, and I think it's in the book, I believe I put it in, was that at the end of World War One, where radio technology on the front was already beginning to be used, the American generals and field leaders in Europe felt safer, didn't want to use the radio technology because they didn't trust it and preferred homing pigeons, which tells you, how far we've come. That was, in the late 1917-1918 era. 2 years later, radio starts to have a market, and it was Sarnoff who took that idea of broadcasting and drove it, and a guy in Pittsburgh actually named Frank Conrad, who was instrumental in doing it. But this whole idea of reaching multiple people, multiple audiences, with the same message was all new. This had never come about before.
Had hardly even occurred to be. It never dawned on people that it would be possible and maybe even desirable.
Exactly. I mean, why would you want to do that? I mean, I somebody said to me recently, well, what made you, who were you thinking of when you were writing the book? And I have this image in my head of some farmer in Iowa who goes to the town, goes to the big city, Des Moines, let's say, and this is 1921, and he goes for his one big trip a year to town, and he comes home to his, 1,000-acre farm, and he goes up to his house, and he says, look what I bought, dear. And she says, what's that? And he says, well, it's a radio. And she goes, well, what does it do? And he says, well, you put the battery in, and you turn it on, and late at night, we can listen to news and music from New York. And she says, boy, you've been drinking again. I mean, the concept that sound could travel thousands of miles to reach you in your home was all new.
Hmm.
We take it for granted.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think any book that helps us not take something important for granted is a valuable book. Let me rewind for just a moment.
Sure.
All of this in terms of the business of radio really begins in about 1920. But ahead of that, for instance, you talk about early experiments in which they are fervently, that is, certain scientists, technicians, are fervently trying to develop a technology where the voice can travel in a way that it hadn't before. For instance, I was excited as an opera fan to read about way back in 1910.
Yeah.
I mean, 10 years before the first radio station is in any kind of operation at all, the voice of Enrico Caruso is transmitted from the stage of the Met to a handful of listeners in some other location. Tell us what the point of, for instance, an experiment like that was.
Well, the engineers always had this idea of how can we get sound to travel? And that was the launching point. How can we expand where it travels to?
So this is, in a sense, a little bit like a different kind of telephone.
Oh, absolutely.
It could still be a person to a person, but you wouldn't have wires.
Absolutely correct. Great analogy. It's as if you were, you know, and they weren't that far away. I mean, they were on, you know, Park Avenue, and the Met was on Broadway. So it wasn't like they were trying to send it clear across New York City. It was a few blocks away. And they had a little receiver, and yes, they had Caruso. I think he was singing something from Cavalleria, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And they broadcasted, or they sent this signal, and apparently even a couple of ships at sea, which had receiving equipment, heard the signal.
Hmm.
So it did. You know, then they started realizing, well, this is bouncing all over the place. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
But that was 1910, and if you think about it, it took a whole decade. Now, part of the problem was you had World War I in the middle, where the United States government shut down all radio equipment in this country as a security measure. So that sort of slowed things down by 3 years.
Now, let me just ask, it seems absurd that somebody would not be achieving success with transmitting the voice of Enrico Caruso and not think to themselves, wait a minute, this means all kinds of people could listen to Enrico Caruso singing live, and you wouldn't have to be inside the Metropolitan Opera House.
Right.
I mean, that would be, but the way you write about this, it seems like this was not the seed that germinated all of this, that even this experiment, which to us seems so incredibly exciting and seems to make this new possibility so evident, it sounds like it still did not quite occur to people what all of this ultimately was going to mean.
I don't think anyone knew yet, because it was so different from anything that had existed before. I mean, the only model you had of getting sound from one point to another was the telephone. And even that, you know, not everybody had one. It wasn't that ubiquitous then. So this idea that you could take sound and send it through the air, well, great. What do you do with it? What's the point of it?
So there's still nothing like a radio that would be in everybody's home and that sort of thing.
No, there was no thought of that at all in 1910. Hmm. It was, how do I just get sound from point A to point B?
Right.
and that was the initial thrust of it. And then it wasn't until 1920, 21, 22 when someone finally realized, hold it a second, I can reach more people and have a greater impact. I mean, the number I love to toss out is in November of 1920, when KDKA, as an experiment, broadcast the election results, they estimate that somewhere between 500 and 1,000 people had pretty much homemade receivers in those days, radios, and could listen to those results. 12 years after that, and this is, you know, when people talk about the growth of the Internet, I kind of laugh, because it was all built on what came before, whereas this was totally new. 12 years later, when FDR beat Hoover and the radio networks covered that election night coast to coast, they estimate that somewhere between 50 and 60 million people heard it.
Wow. There's never been anything that sprung into life that dramatically.
No industry, no communication tool has ever gone from 500 to 50 million in 12 years.
I want to turn back to this important figure of David Sarnoff and read a memorandum of his that you quote in your book. This comes from 1916.
Yep.
So this is yet a few years before there is the first radio station and before anybody has purchased anything called a radio for their home. But he wrote in what you say is a in-house corporate memorandum, "I have in mind a plan of development which would make radio a household utility in the same sense as the piano or phonograph. The receiver can be designed in the form of a simple radio music box and arranged for several different wavelengths, which would be changeable with the throwing of a single switch or pressing of a single button. The box can be placed in the parlor or living room, the switch set accordingly, and the transmitted music received."
Right.
And in those few relatively simple words, a revolution is born.
Yeah, and that was the memorandum that his boss told him to burn.
Right.
Because he said, that's never going to happen. Forget about it.
Well, in fact,
and of course, 4 years later, it did.
But you point out that one of the problems, You call it one of the great chicken and egg situations to ever confront business. Why would anyone buy a radio if there was nothing of value to listen to? And why would anyone create programming to send to a radio if nobody owns the device?
Right.
I mean, that is the conundrum. And yeah. If there hadn't been a couple people sort of giving this a shove, it's hard to say when it would have finally sprung into being.
Well, if it hadn't been really for the hobbyists. Radio was a hobby in those days. You know, people had their little wireless home-built sets in their garages. And if it hadn't been for those people, it would have never happened, because businesses wouldn't have invested if there was no audience. And people wouldn't build radios if no one was going to provide content. So you had a company like Westinghouse, which built the radios and had Frank Conrad creating content via KDKA, which was, you know, so they built the radios and they owned the radio station. So you had a few places that were going to begin to do that. But it was a tremendous chicken and egg issue. You know, why would you do it if no one's listening? And why would you listen if, why would you buy a radio if there's nothing to listen to?
Hmm.
But what struck me in doing the research on this is that the number of brilliant people who came to radio and sort of made the industry, and people who we've forgotten about today. I mean, the title of the book, Hello Everybody, comes from Roxy Rothafel, who most people have forgotten. I mean, there's the great line in Guys and Dolls, what's playing at the Roxy? Well, that was the theater named for him. And Roxy Rothafel was a radio producer who was a genius.
I mean, and now completely forgotten.
And completely forgotten. He was the man who was in charge of Radio City Music Hall's opening. That's how important he was. We've forgotten about him. A guy like Rudy Valley, who we think of kind of as an icon of the Roaring Twenties, you know, the guy with the raccoon coat and the megaphone.
If we think of him at all.
If you think of him at all, exactly. But Rudy Valley may have been the most important radio producer of the 1920s. He changed the way we listen to radio, the way we present entertainment. And that, the format he created in 1932, the variety show, is the same variety show that Ed Sullivan did, that Johnny Carson did. I mean, it just, you know, traveled right through the 20th century. Hmm. And then my favorite one, and I tell kids this all the time who think that a show like American Idol is so brilliant, American Idol is nothing new. American Idol was done on the radio in 1930 by Major Bowes, who, by the way, was hired by Roxy Rothafel. Major Bowes' talent hour was young amateurs singing, and people would phone in and vote for which one they liked. There's nothing new in that, in what American Idol does. It's Major Bowes' talent hour, except we use cell phones now.
We're talking with Anthony Rudell. We're talking about his book, Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. So there is a moment which is, you call, the debut of radio broadcasting, and it is election night 1920, yep. November 2nd, where for maybe an audience between 500 and 1,000, hear election results read over the air from this experimental radio station, and in a sense, radio broadcasting is born. You've talked about how this takes off like a rocket in mm-hmm. terms of other radio stations springing into being. And you spend quite a bit of the book talking about the government scrambling to figure out how to control this new technology. I mean, to control it or to organize it or to keep it from exploding into utter chaos. And one of the central figures is a future president, Herbert Hoover.
Yeah, the irony of Herbert Hoover, as I discovered in this, is that Herbert Hoover, the president who had more executive experience, a buzz phrase we hear all the time now, who had more executive experience than anyone else, may have been a terrible president and had some economic difficulties, shall we say, during his presidency. But the 8 years prior to his presidency, when he was Secretary of Commerce, first under Harding and then under Coolidge, the man was a genius. There is absolutely no other way to put it. This man took something as new and that it was not understood as radio, grasped its significance, and decided, even though he did not believe in government intervention in business, decided that here was a business where government needed to be involved, because otherwise you'd have chaos. And he, as head of the Commerce Department, guided radio's growth from 1921 until the time he stepped down in late 1927 to run for president, by which time the Radio Act of 1927, which he basically authored, was passed and created the Federal Radio Commission, which later became the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission.
Now, as we're talking about Herbert Hoover, give us a sense of just how rapidly radio stations were springing into being.
Oh,
you've already given us a little sense of how quickly people started buying radios, but what about this matter of radio stations?
They were adding literally, well, first of all, everyone who had an amateur license suddenly applied for a regular license. So the Commerce Department had a backlog of approvals to send through, and they were sending them through one after the other. But I don't remember the exact numbers of growth, but if you take 1920, there may have been a handful of radio stations in the country. By 1924, I think the number was up to 600, and it just kept growing at that pace, and it was astounding what you had. I mean, 1927, I think you were up to 900 or 1,000 radio stations in this country. That is huge growth. And to organize what frequency they were all going to be on and what hours of operation they were all going to be on. You see, that's the other thing that today's audiences don't understand. We live in an era of 24/7 broadcasting. I mean, radio stations are on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Television stations are on 24, and the Internet is always there. Back then, radio stations shut down, especially in the early 20s. They would, you know, somebody would turn on the radio station at 9 in the morning and maybe do a show from 9 to 10, and then they'd turn off the transmitter and maybe come back at 3 in the afternoon for an hour. Sometimes there was a story of a station in Schenectady, New York, that announced it was closing for 2 days because they had nothing to broadcast. So this sort of, it was a very random thing, and again, this slowed the growth, and yet the growth didn't slow because stations kept getting added. And more listeners kept coming in, and more radio receivers were being bought, and it steadily grew and grew and grew. And then in 1926, Sarnoff realized, boy, would there be great if we could create a network, and that's when NBC was formed, the National Broadcasting Corporation.
And explain to us, I mean, although in some respects it's probably obvious, but I don't think entirely so, what a leap forward that was. I mean, what was the difference between that and radio as it had been known before?
Well, what was interesting, and again, looking back at the presidential campaigns, is that when Al Smith, well, go before that, when in 24, Coolidge was going to make his acceptance speech, and one of the things I didn't know is that acceptance speeches were not given at the convention, but some months later, usually a month and a half after the convention. So Coolidge is giving his acceptance speech in 1924 for the nomination, and the Washington Post lists the stations around the country that are going to carry it, and there might have been 40 radio stations that were going to carry it. Well, this was big. It was the largest group of stations ever assembled. Well, when you get to 1928, suddenly all you need to do is have NBC carry it, and you're going to be on all the NBC affiliates around the country. And this concept, which was, again, Sarnoff, of having lots of stations affiliated with a network, which was based in New York, which combined stations that NBC owned, or that RCA owned, actually, with stations they didn't own but provided programming to, was unique. And it enabled him to create better programming. NBC was the lead network. Obviously, CBS came along, thanks to Paley, a year later. But he created this idea that you could create great programming that was heard all around the country, which also led to national radio advertising, which was new, so that you then see the effect. You suddenly have national brands being created so that you could advertise the same product in New York and in San Francisco.
As opposed to this sort of crazy quilt of individual stations scattered all over the country.
Exactly.
Each one doing their own thing and in rather, and sometimes fairly disorganized fashion.
Exactly.
Help us understand how radio was experienced in the cities versus in rural America. I mean, was it equally valued in both of those kind of situations?
You know, I think it was valued very differently. I mean, in the rural areas, some of the things that struck me, there was a wonderful story I found about how radio was helping the farmers. And one of the things it did is it, the Agriculture Department, in conjunction with the Commerce Department, interestingly, decided that radio could be used to give important information to the rural farming community in America. And so every morning they would have market prices for the farmers. And there's a wonderful story about a woman, a farmer, who goes to sell her eggs at market, and the guy says, well, I'll give you, you know, a 10 cents a dozen. And she says, oh, no, market price is 12 cents a dozen. And he says, well, how do you know that? She said, I heard it on the radio this morning. Mm. So all of a sudden, the rural community is using this not only for entertainment, but for information. It becomes very important, which is less important in the metropolitan areas. But what was interesting to me in looking at this is sort of a two-way street of entertainment, especially in the earliest years where there wasn't a lot of content yet. So you have, the rural community late at night can turn on their radio and hear a dance orchestra playing in the Plaza Hotel in New York. Or, you know, there was a radio station in Chicago. I think the call letters were WMBB, which stood for World's Most Beautiful Ballroom. And this was, you know, every night you could flip on WMBB and listen to a different orchestra playing dance music of the 20s. And I think the sophistication, if you will, of the streets of the urban communities filtered into these rural communities. Although sometimes you found the rural communities filtering into the urban communities. I don't remember what year it was, but there was one where I noticed the New York radio station was carrying that night the Ozark, Arkansas Fiddlers Contest, which must have sounded very unique on the streets of New York, you know. But so there was a two-way street, although really what you started having, especially when the networks came along, was, you know, the big cities, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, filtering their programming to the rest of the country.
Right. And I think you write so well when you say that, you know, some people looked at this as perhaps another fad because the 1920s were full of passing fads. But clearly the radio telephone had progressed from a hobby to a staple luxury, and radio had become a unifier.
Yep.
Not only within communities, but between them as it brought the sounds of urban life to rural areas. There are some dramatic moments that we should touch on, and one of them occurs in July of 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee.
Yep.
And an incredibly dramatic trial involving William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow. Explain how early radio is a part of this incredibly dramatic moment.
Well, once again, you know, you're dealing with a blank canvas of programming. What am I going to put on my radio station? So I think it was WGN Chicago didn't know what to do with their radio station. So they said, well, there's this trial going on in Dayton, Tennessee. So they ran phone lines literally from Chicago to Dayton, Tennessee, and they decided to set up a microphone in the courtroom, and the judge agreed to turn the courtroom around so they could get better sound, which I thought was kind of interesting, and they decided to broadcast the trial, the Scopes monkey trial. And you've got two great orators in Bryan and Darrow, and you have a fascinating case, and they assigned, and I don't remember the man's name, but they assigned him to cover the events, and he sat in a little room off the courtroom where he would fill in when there was a gap. He would say, and now William Jennings Bryan approaches the bench. And he would do the play-by-play, and then you would hear Bryan or Darrow or the witness or whoever speak. And it was a tremendous thing that Dayton, Tennessee was flooded with media, but only WGN carried it as a radio show. And it was a live radio show. And then they hung around at the end, and then Bryan gave his closing argument on a hill and dies 3 days later. I mean, you couldn't, if you wrote it as a Hollywood script, they'd reject it because it's too dramatic. But it must have been phenomenal radio. I mean, imagine sitting in Chicago on a hot summer day, and what did you do today? Well, I listened to the monkey trial. Had to be pretty good radio.
Wow. Also, something that became a dramatic source of programming was the world of sports.
Yes.
I want to read one of my favorite moments in the whole book. This is when you are talking about baseball being broadcast over the radio back in the early 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And you're quoting somebody talking about the wonder of this. somebody, I think, from the New York Times saying, the tremendous speed of the radio waves, 186,000 miles a second, will carry the World Series of 1922 around the world 7.5 times a second, so that if Babe Ruth drives out a home run, the radio listeners will know as soon as the ball drops in the bleachers and before Babe crosses the home plate. I mean, somebody in Fargo, North Dakota will know that Babe Ruth has hit a home run before he himself has even crossed the plate.
Yeah.
I mean, that really is, I mean, we don't ever stop to think about that. I mean, it's not easy for us to really feel wonderment about that in this day and age. But reading about their wonderment back in 1922 gives us at least a taste of it.
Well, it had to be so incredibly transformative to be sitting in any town America and you have this box and you turn it on a hot afternoon or a cool afternoon since the series is usually in October, and you hear the greats playing and you realize that when you hear the crack of the bat, it's that instant. And it transported people. People felt as if they were in the stadium. And, of course, it led to whole new careers. I mean, Graham McNamee was an opera singer who became a radio announcer and became the pivotal sports announcer of his day. We don't remember him today. No one, you know, go up to 1,000 people on the street and say, who was Graham McNamee? I assure you, no one's going to know who he was. But the man was among the most important radio figures of the 1920s. But this notion that you could hear something happen that quickly was awe-inspiring in the 20s. And as you said, and I agree with you 100%, we take it so for granted today that I can pick up my cell phone and reach somebody thousands of miles away instantaneously. But back then, this was all new. I mean, people had trouble getting a phone call through back then on a landline. So this idea that you could be sitting in your living room with this box and listening to, you know, the crack of Babe Ruth's bat, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Of course, one thing that is so striking, and it's in the sense it's one of those the more things change, the more they stay the same scenarios, is that there are people almost from the first instant who want to take radio and exploit it for their own gain. Talk about a couple of the most intriguing figures, maybe beginning with this guy from Little Milford, Kansas.
Yeah, Milford, Kansas, 10 miles from the geographic center of the United States. Dr. John Romulus Brinkley, whose medical degree came from a mail order house, basically, moves to Milford, Kansas towards the end of the 19-teens, about 1917, 1918. Sets up shop there. He's the only doctor in town, and his business is going okay, and I won't go into all the details, but he's not doing great. And a few years later, a guy comes in and says he's having a problem, and things aren't going well, and the conversation gets around to the fact the guy finally says, well, I have a flat tire, which we have different names for today, but that's what they called it back then. And since there was no Viagra, Brinkley comes up with this idea of implanting goat tissue into the man to make him a man again. I'm not going to give you all the details because I don't want to ruin the book for people, but basically what ends up happening is Brinkley becomes a star surgeon, goes out to Los Angeles where Harry Chandler, who owns the Los Angeles Times, says, well, if you can, you know, do this surgery successfully on one of my editors, I'll make you a star. But while Brinkley's in Los Angeles doing surgeries for a number of different people, Chandler puts KHJ radio, which some people thought stood for kindness, happiness, and joy, which I just love because it's Los Angeles, KHJ on the air. Brinkley sees the possibilities of this, goes back to Kansas, sends a letter to the Commerce Department requesting a license, and gets KFKB, which stands for Kansas Folks Know Best, or Kansas First, Kansas Best, and builds the first radio station in Kansas, and goes on the air and becomes one of the great radio doctors, where he tells people how to cure themselves. And of course, all the cures require either coming to Milford, Kansas and having a surgery, or sending money to Milford, Kansas, and he'll send you the cure. So it's ex- exactly like when you turn on the TV late at night and you see these, you know, doctors call 1-800 now. It's the same concept. It just goes back to 1926, 27.
These are some of the very first infomercials.
It was the first, and he ran his entire radio station without using a single advertising dollar, which Hoover loved because Hoover was against advertising from the beginning. So Brinkley runs this radio station. He's making so much money that he builds a new hospital, a new school, a new post office. He hires half the town of Milford to run his business, and he's cleaning up. Well, eventually the AMA, American Medical Association, comes after him for being a quack. And then the Federal Radio Commission in the late 20s, you know, says he's using his radio station for personal gain, which you're not supposed to do, and they shut him down. And he ends up running for governor of Kansas in 1930. And if it hadn't been for the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, 2 weeks before the election conspiring against him, Brinkley would have become governor of Kansas. And I won't tell the rest of the story because I don't want to ruin it
right for
the readers. But, you know, the infomercial, the medical infomercial, which we still see today, was pioneered by Brinkley. So he was one of the interesting ones. There's a guy up in Iowa named Norman Baker who claimed to have the cure for cancer and put it on the air and became heavily involved in politics as a result of his radio station in Muscatine, Iowa. And then, of course, you know, the one area we haven't touched on is the religious broadcasters who dominate parts of media today still. But you have the great story of Amy Semple McPherson, this woman who used to do, you know, tent services, tent revival meetings across the country, gets to Los Angeles, and is so popular because she has a radio station that she ultimately builds the largest temple, the Angelus Temple. And there's a whole story of her disappearance, which is kind of funny and very typical of the 1920s.
It's amazing. And we, as we read these stories, we are sort of reminded of the power of mass media for good or for ill. One of the things that's so striking as we reach our last couple of minutes here, of course, with the savage financial downturn that the United States is facing right now, and with all kinds of recollections of what our country experienced with the Great Depression, it's really striking to read what radio meant to Americans in those days. And in particular, you tell us that one of the oddest things maybe about Americans' interest in radio was that they turned to radio for escape and for reality.
Yeah.
And even in the depths of the Depression, most listeners wanted an ample supply of both from their radio.
Yeah, it's a strange dichotomy, actually. And as I was researching, I realized that radio provided two things, especially as you get to the late 20s and early 30s. It provided an instant source of information and news, what was really going on in the world, whether it be sports or politics or financial news. They turned to radio for instantaneous coverage of that. I mean, I suppose the defining moment in a certain way was the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, which became one of the first stories to break on the radio. So people did turn to radio for that dose of reality, but what they, in equal measure and perhaps a little more, they turned to radio as, I think you used the word escape, and that's exactly what it was. This fantasy land that you could create, you know, tonight we broadcast from the roof of the Drake Hotel, and this sort of, you could be in the middle of Nowheresville, America, late at night, turn on the radio, and suddenly you were on a dance floor on Fifth Avenue in New York, or in Chicago, or listening to a jazz band in another city, you know, and it had this ability. And the great entertainers who came to radio, especially at the end of the 20s and into the 30s, the Rudy Valleys, the Ed Wynn, the Will Rogers, so that there was this strange dichotomy or duality, if you will, between going to the radio for your politics, to listen to the great speeches of the day, and yet also to escape, to listen to comedy or to listen to, and this is what Rudy Valley did so brilliantly, and Roxy Rothafel as well, understanding the need to blend things. If you look at the list of guests who appeared on the Rudy Valley show, it was everyone from Babe Ruth to Mayor Jimmy Walker of New York. It was the great musicians of the day. It was the great actors of the day, especially My book ends in 1933, but Valley continued with his show into 1939. 10 years in the same time slot with the same sponsor. That was amazing when you think about that. But you're right. Americans turned to radio to get away from it all for a while, to, you know, be at Yankee Stadium for the World Series, to listen to the call of Babe Ruth's called shot in the 32 series. I mean, these were magical moments that the radio listener could sit at home and be part of.
And at a moment when a lot of Americans desperately needed a little magic in their lives.
Oh, absolutely. It was the way to get away from the depression that was gripping the country.
And ultimately, radio, so ironically, helps bring about the downfall of one of the men who was so important in its creation, Herbert Hoover. That's another story that people need to explore in this fascinating book.
Yeah, one of the most amazing twists is the man who who built it, ultimately in 1932, is defeated by it because Roosevelt is just so much better on the radio than Hoover. And Hoover, many people say, loses the presidency in 32. I mean, partially, obviously, because of the economic downturn, but because the Democrats understood how to outmaneuver. And we, you know, we talk about that today in politics. How quickly can you respond? The Democrats understood that if Hoover says something on the radio, you needed to respond. And they did it. And Roosevelt was, first of all, a dynamic speaker. I mean, you listen to the fireside chats, which you can hear. The man was incredible, his connectivity to the audience. I think I quote the actress Lillian Gish, who hears him on the radio and says, your voice is like phosphorescent. He connects to the American people as no person had before. And poor Herbert Hoover, who, you know, was just unlucky to be in the White House in 1929 and certainly didn't help himself through those first 3 years, saying that, you know, things are getting better, don't worry. Roosevelt just outmaneuvers him completely and beats him on the radio.
And it's one more way in which radio utterly changes America.
Oh, wow.
And embodies America in so many ways, which
is
also
correct.
Part of the spirit of your book. The book, again, is called Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. It's published by Harcourt, the author, Anthony Rudell. Anthony Rudell, I congratulate you on one of the most interesting books I've read in a long, long time, and I'm glad we could talk about it on today's morning show. My best wishes to you, and thanks.
Thank you so much.
This interview came from the Morning Show Archives, an interview recorded in early 2010. Next week on the Morning Show, we have some very interesting interviews scheduled, beginning on Monday with a visit from Deborah Ford, who is Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And we look forward to catching up with her. Next week's interviews will include also on Tuesday the author of a new book called American Princess, which tells the story of the relationship between Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, who of course are going to be married in mid-May. On Wednesday, I'm very excited to share with you my interview with Ellen Meacham, the author of a book called Delta Epiphany, Robert F. Kennedy in Mississippi. This recounts in remarkable detail Robert F. Kennedy's visit to the poverty-stricken Mississippi Delta in early 1967. It was a very powerful, even transformative experience for then-Senator Kennedy. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. From WGTD's community calendar, two big music events at Carthage this weekend, tonight and tomorrow afternoon, Mozart's masterpiece Don Giovanni, performed free to the public in Siebert Chapel. Tonight, 7:30, tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock. Again, Mozart's Don Giovanni. And Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods opens this weekend at Carthage in the Wartburg Auditorium, running this weekend and the following weekend. Tickets can be purchased through carthage.edu.